Did Ukraine attack the Nord Stream pipeline? Is the German coalition government about to collapse over just a handful of billions of euros? Will the EU be able to censor what you say and hear, no matter where you live in the world? And how soon until Iran gets a nuclear weapon? We're going to talk about all this and more on today's Week in Review edition of Trumpet World. Elon Musk's interview with President Donald Trump was probably the most watched news interview of the week. It's perhaps just as notable for the reaction to it as what Mr. Trump actually said. And here to tell us more about it is our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yes, I normally actually don't like talking about interviews on the Week in Review program. I like to focus on like things that actually happened rather than people talking about things that happened. Although in this case, whenever Elon Musk and Donald Trump, the richest man in the world and the Republican front runner, both actually on the top 500 richest people in the world, is news. Over a million people tuned in to watch it. So like the whole world was really kind of just fixated on this interview for a while. And they covered a wide range of topics. They talked about immigration. They talked about the Biden administration. They talked about climate change. They talked about AI. They talked about bridges. Really just a fascinating look into the minds of two fascinating people. I think one of my parts, I think, that happened that might help Trump's campaign the most is Elon Musk. He actually came out and like owned up to the fact that he's been a big climate change advocate and has actually supported a lot of liberal causes over the years. He voted for Barack Obama in both elections. He voted for Hillary Clinton. He voted for Joe Biden. So he's not a diehard Republican by any means. But then just leveled with people, he admitted that he was wrong and said that the Biden administration, which he thought was going to be moderate, was so radical that he really feels like even the moderate liberals have to support Donald Trump. Not because Trump's necessarily a moderate liberal, but just because the radical left has gone so radical that even the moderate liberals are almost, they're closer to the Republican side than they are to the Democratic side. And Elon Musk knows that better than most. Like I said, he's not far right. He just believes in free speech, which has now just recently become a thing that only apparently right-wing people believe in because the media's come down so hard against free speech. And that's actually when Trump was kicked off Twitter, that's actually like the straw that broke the camel's back that prompted Elon Musk to buy Twitter. Because back then he wasn't a Trump supporter yet. And he said, he's like, well, I don't support Trump. But he's like, the fact that these social media companies can kick off a sitting president is insane. And so he spent $45 million of his own money to buy this company and just really help restore some free speech for America. And the world just has really hated him for it. There's actually a Democratic super PAC in the United States that's actually trying to sue Elon Musk for the interview, saying that Twitter sponsored this interview. And when there were some technical glitches, paid Twitter staff dealt with the technical glitches. So they're trying to prosecute it as a campaign violation. They said you can't support Donald Trump using your own company and then not be a campaign violation. And I don't think that particular lawsuit's going to get very far.
Well, presumably if it does, you can go after CNN for exactly the same thing, and MSNBC and all of these left-supporting news organizations. Presumably they would also be guilty of campaign violations in favor of the Democrats.
Right. It'll be an easy case to win. I don't think either are sweating it all that much. But it does show the spirit in the radical left in America that if you get up on a company you own and have a leading political candidate in there who's talking about how the other political candidate is radical, they're like, if you speak against us, we might not have the power yet to legally shut that down, but they have the desire to shut that down. And that's why Elon Musk is talking about, is like I said, we really need some free speech in America. It's like not even as a conservative versus a liberal thing, just for like a functioning democracy. to work. We're as bad as it is in the United States, and it's getting bad in the United States. I think it's even worse, and probably has been for some time, in the European Union. Elon Musk was telling Donald Trump that he got a letter from like the European Commission the day before the interview saying there better not be any misinformation in this video you're planning to have, or we'll censor it in Europe, which is crazy. Musk is another trouble with the EU. He said some things critical of the rioting in the UK a week or so back, and so the European Commission's on his case for that as well. Both Elon Musk and Donald Trump, that's why this interview is so fascinating, because they have a lot of powerful enemies around the world, both in the radical left in the United States and in the European Union, who just really don't like free speech.
And it's that response to the interview that stands out, at least to me, more than the interview itself. Like, that just says so much about contemporary American politics, where you have a political candidate that people just don't want an interview with. Like, just like if you imagine Ronald Reagan or even George W. Bush, or like, it is wrong for them to even sit down and host an interview with the US public. And especially if it's a former president, that is crazy. And then Europe's reaction, I think, is also really, really revealing. It shows so much about their attitude towards freedom of speech. I think this is from Thierry Breton's letter that you just mentioned. He said, "We're monitoring the potential risks in the EU associated with the dissemination of content that may incite violence, hate, and racism in conjunction with major political or societal events around the world." And he goes on to basically say, "Look, we think that you haven't even done the interview yet, but we think you're going to break the law, and we're trying to intimidate you into not doing it." But it exposes the truth behind all of these different institutions, you know, the radical left and the European Union. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had an article in the April Trumpet print edition. It's called "The EU's War on Free Speech." And he wrote there, "We need to pay close attention to the authoritarian tendencies of today's European leaders. If you don't think like they do, they call your views disinformation and they just destroy you. And they gain more control and power, and the war on free speech is destined to turn violent." I mean, this is incredible what they're doing here. You have an interview of a former US president in a US presidential election conducted on US soil by a US company, and the EU steps in and says, "We don't think you should be allowed to do that." That is breathtaking in their ambition to stifle free speech around the world. I mean, we saw it in the UK. I think it was kind of more ridiculous because the UK doesn't have as much power as the EU on these regulatory matters, where you had the head of Britain's Metropolitan Police, I think it was, say, threaten to extradite Elon Musk. It's absurd. You know, he disagreed with what he said over the riots, and he was like, "Well, we're going to come after Elon Musk. We want to put him in jail." It's unhinged. I'm sure he knows that that is not going to happen, that you can't just extradite someone from the United States where they have First Amendment protection. But there's an unhinged spirit, and it's an unhinged spirit within Britain's politicians. It's there at the top of Europe, where their beliefs are all that matters, and they're going to impose them anywhere in the world. And when it comes to Europe, I mean, they're kind of doing some of that already. Facebook, Twitter standing up a bit, but Google, you know, a lot of these companies, YouTube, they want to do business in Europe. They know that Europe then can use that to threaten them or fine them. Billions of pounds is lost. And a lot of these companies don't have the backbone of someone like Elon Musk. And if it's a case of paying or censoring free speech a little in the way that the EU wants, they broadly think the same way. Mark Zuckerberg and some of these others and Google, you know, they think kind of the same way as European elites anyway. So they go along with it. And so... what does that say, though, that Europe wants to censor speech all around the world? And I think that's what no one really is talking about, and something that Mr. Flurry's article really gets into. That what does it say about the character of this European power that they want to dominate censorship anywhere you are? We want to control what you have to say. It shows the spirit of this empire that's rising in Europe. It's the same spirit that we've seen before. It's the spirit of the Holy Roman Empire. Mr. Flurry wrote, "European history is filled with examples of what happened when leaders attained great heights of power. Study the medieval Holy Roman Empire, for example, and you can see how they dealt with disinformation. They accused people of heresy, then tortured or killed them. Bible prophecy is clear that this is not merely history, however. Soon Germany, at the head of a European empire, a modern resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, will ascend as the world's preeminent superpower. And I think people might, maybe you've heard some of these prophecies, maybe you've heard us talk about Europe rising as a superpower, and you've thought, well, you know, do they really want to dominate the world? Is that maybe a bit extreme? And you see fulfilled prophecy in what Europe is doing here. And it exposes that spirit. Anyway, sorry, Andrew. If you weren't going to talk about this as your main story, I was going to talk about it as the main European story. I've hijacked it a bit to get in my European angle. I think you were going to talk a little bit more about how it ties into some of the prophecy for the United States as well.
Well, I think I can do a little bit of both, and then you might have more to want to say on the European angle. But one thing you can find on our website is our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, did a Key of David a few years ago titled Daniel 8:12, A Dual Prophecy. And it talks about this verse in Daniel 8:12 about this Antiochus figure that cast the truth to the ground. That particular Key of David program is called a dual prophecy because he's focusing on there's an Antiochus figure who casts truth to the ground in the church. And there's an Antiochus figure who trashed truth to the ground politically in the United States of America. Although, of course, if you reread some of our other literature, you'll know that there's also a third Antiochus figure who cast truth to the ground in a modern revival of the Holy Roman Empire. So three Antiochus figures, and one in God's church, one in the United States, one in Europe, all very different people in some ways. But all kind of sharing the same hatred of free speech, if you could put it that way. The Antiochus figure in the church, if you've listened to this program for a while, you'll know that actually claimed it was his Christian duty to keep Mr. Armstrong's books, Mystery of the Ages, out of print. The Antiochus figure in the United States has deep connections in Silicon Valley and has pulled a lot of strings to make sure things like the Hunter Biden laptop and other information that could hurt his political control over the country, no one finds out about them. They're censored from Twitter. Elon Musk has helped push back against that some by buying Twitter, but it was really bad back when Barack Obama was actually in power. And then there's another one in Europe that you see the same spirit where they hear that Elon Musk and Donald Trump are going to have an interview, and they send him a letter that day saying that, like, if you say anything in this interview that we don't agree with, there's going to be consequences. And so you definitely see it's a spirit of casting truth to the ground where you're like, they don't even let people decide if they want to believe what Trump said about global warming or the European car market is true. The fear is like, you can't decide for yourself because, like, we're not even going to let you hear about it. It's like, you will believe what we tell you to believe or else.
I'm really glad you brought that up. I think that's an excellent way of just showing how directly this relates to Bible prophecy. And I think this is really interesting as well. If you go to the latest Trumpet print edition, Mr. Flory has an article in there where, you know, he talks about this Antiochus that he just mentioned. And he also goes to some other prophecies that show that God is beginning to silence this Antiochus. And he talks about how Barack Obama fulfilled that role. And he says Barack Obama's power is diminishing before our eyes. And elsewhere, he's talked about how, okay, well, as you see this Barack Obama, this Antiochus in America diminish, there is this third European Antiochus that's going to suppress truth in the same way that's going to come on the scene. And as you see Barack Obama's power diminishing, who is kind of stepping up to be the global force trying to censor Twitter? It's the European Union. You see that spirit of Antiochus rising in Europe. And I'm not saying Thierry Breton, that particular European leader, is that Antiochus. I think it's quite possible that he's influenced by that Antiochus, but I really thought that was a very valuable aspect to bring out. But of course, that wasn't the only news story from the United States this week. I think you've got a quick rundown for us, Andrew, of some of the other top pieces of news.
Yeah, there's always a ton going on in the Anglo-American region. One of the more disturbing stories I heard this year that a lot of people probably don't think about is that the United States shipbuilding is in its worst state in 25 years. That a new report, AP News reported on it this week. They said within the decade, America's only going to have about 300 naval ships, where China will probably have something close to 430 something. So America has already fallen below China in terms of just absolute number of naval ships and really not building much more, which makes, in the case of a future trade war or a war over sea gates, which is prophesied in Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, America just doesn't have the resources it used to defend those sea gates. We're also seeing another misinformation attack. We already talked a little bit about Elon Musk comments on the riots in Britain, but one of the few British intelligence agents that everyone in America probably should know is Christopher Steele, wrote the famous Steele dossier, falsely accusing Donald Trump of collusion with Russia. Now he's back to his old tricks, saying that Moscow was behind some of the protests against immigration in the UK and is trying to get UK politician Nigel Farage investigated for something to do with those riots. So looks like possibly another fake dossier in the works on Christopher Steele's part.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Well, we also continue to have remarkable news from Ukraine. I think we've gotten very quickly to the idea that a land war in Europe involving hundreds of tanks and tens of thousands, maybe even more men, is kind of normal. And it often doesn't even kind of make it into the top stories on the headlines. But even this normal war has kind of now reached a more abnormal stage where we're seeing more pieces of news about that. So we'll get an update on what's been going on in Ukraine this week from Jeremiah.
Yes, this truly is a momentous war. I'm glad you mentioned that about sort of the perils of thinking that this is ordinary, because it's a truly momentous story. And Ukraine's invasion of Russia is now continuing on. This is actually the first time that Russia has been invaded by a foreign army since World War II. And when we spoke about this Ukrainian invasion of Russia's Kursk region last week, it was only about 130 square miles of Russian land that Ukraine controlled. But in the days since then, they've pushed deeper in, and Ukraine now controls close to 400 square miles. This area covers at least 44 Russian cities, towns, and settlements. And Russia doesn't dispute this. They've actually declared a federal level state of emergency now, not just for Kursk, but also for the neighboring region of Belgorod, just to the south of Kursk. And if you look at this amount of land on a map and compare it to the front lines in Ukraine, it's clear that Ukraine has now captured more of Russia in about a week than the Russians have captured in Ukraine in roughly 8 months. And some of these cities and towns that Ukraine now controls are quite populous as well. If you add up all the populations, you get tens of thousands, possibly even about 100,000 Russian civilians that are now in occupied territory of the Ukrainian military. These Russians are being allowed to evacuate if they wish to. There are also hundreds of Russian soldiers that have either been captured by Ukrainian forces or have surrendered to them. But this invasion has been dramatic and lightning fast, and it seems to have caught the Russians almost entirely off guard. And then on Wednesday, the Ukrainians combined this land invasion with a massive drone attack, actually the largest drone attack in the entire 2.5 years since this war has gone full scale. Well over 100 drones were fired, and Russia was able to shoot most of them down. But from what we can tell, they got the majority of them, but not all of them, because the swarms were just so thick. They couldn't get them all. The Ukrainians specifically targeted Russian air bases, and they did manage to strike four of those bases. These are in Savosleka, Borisoglebsk, Voronezh, and Kursk. And by hitting these air bases, Ukraine aims to prevent the Russians from being able to use them to carry out strikes on Ukrainian military positions inside of Russia. So that right there shows you that Ukraine is not planning to pull out of Russia anytime soon. And so far, the Russians have not come up with a strategy to push them out. Russia has pulled some of its troops out of Ukraine and redeployed them there in Kursk, but it hasn't been enough yet to change the dynamic. And Vladimir Putin, I wanted to mention a few remarks that he made about this on Monday. He gave an address about this. He was trying to reassure his people that this is a manageable problem. He also promised to give some money to the Russians who have been forced to evacuate their homes. But it's clear in this video that Putin has been bewildered by this whole thing. To him, this sort of thing should not be possible because his advisors, you know, he's arranged it so that his advisors only really give him good news. He's been told for months that Ukraine's military is bound to very soon collapse. That's what his propagandists tell him. You know, they feed him his own propaganda. But then something like this comes along, and he is forced to acknowledge that a lot of what he has been told is not accurate. And you can really see the bewilderment and the anger in him in this video address that he gave. But that doesn't mean that Putin's goals have changed at all. So it's difficult to say exactly how this may change in the days ahead, but we will be keeping a close eye on it.
We're also joined here with Mihailo Zekic, who I think you've got an interesting point to make about some of the historical parallels here.
Yes. As soon as you were talking about that, Jeremiah, the first thing that popped into my head was this sounds a lot like what Joseph Stalin's mental state was immediately before and the German invasion of the Soviet Union and for the first moments after that. Stalin famously only had yes men surrounding him to the point where, say, when people were making economic deliveries through within the Soviet Union itself, different governors or what have you in charge of different regions would abduct other people's shipments of goods just to meet their own quotas to give Stalin good news. And that was the same with the military. And when he and Stalin believed that there was no way Hitler was going to invade the Soviet Union because the Russian trade was too profitable for him. And so then when the invasion actually happened, then he had a bit of a nervous breakdown, retreated to his dacha for several days while all of his military men were not getting any word from him at all and weren't really sure what to do. And the reason that got me a little bit piqued is because our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, has pointed for years and years saying that the path Putin is on right now is similar to Stalin's, and we're going to see him behaving more and more like Stalin. And when he made those comments, I don't remember the years off the top of my head, but Russia, I mean, the Ukraine war obviously hadn't happened yet. Russia was still a quote-unquote normal country. The people were living a lot better lives than, say, they did in the Soviet Union. It may have been easy to look at that and think, oh, that's a bit of an exaggeration. But in this case, you're seeing him actually even make the same patterns of behavior that Joseph Stalin did.
I think that's a really interesting point because, again, I made this point last time. Maybe I was a bit too strong. There is a lot of wishful thinking with Putin because we want Putin out, because he's a bloodthirsty dictator, because a lot of people don't like him. We do tend to leap at every piece of bad news for him and say, that's it, it's over, he's done. And this is certainly bad news. And I think perhaps even more so this week, it seems, than last week. But like you pointed out, Mihailo, he just almost collapsed, Stalin did. And he wasn't down. He kind of looked down and out. It looked like it was pretty much over for him. And he remained, sadly for Russia, in power for a great many more years. I guess he's probably better than Hitler, but he certainly wasn't democratic. But anyway, the point is, it's not necessarily all over for Vladimir Putin. I think the other story from Asia that I was interested to get your thoughts on, Jeremiah, it made me laugh out loud when I first saw it, this headline that Germany had finally issued an arrest warrant for the person involved in sabotaging their undersea Nord Stream gas pipelines. And it was for a diving instructor known only in the arrest warrant, at least, as Volodymyr Z. Which, of course, when the Ukrainian prime minister or president is Volodymyr Zelensky, was pretty funny. The idea that he personally would have gone down into the Baltic and planted these explosives. But then the next day, the Wall Street Journal comes out with an exclusive report saying that, yes, Ukraine is, in fact, to blame. What do you make of that?
It feels like this is possibly the conclusion to a story that's been, you know, really intriguing to many news watchers for, I think it's been about a year now, maybe closer to two, since this pipeline was destroyed. I feel like the evidence that I've seen so far linking it to this Ukrainian individual acting alone is compelling, but I still feel like there's possibly more to this that we don't know.
Yeah, I tend to agree that Ukraine has been my biggest suspect for a long time. I think we had the Seymour Hersh story come out a while ago saying the CIA did it, which, given that there would be so many willing proxies in Eastern Europe, it seemed pretty strange to me that the CIA would do it themselves rather than give themselves a bit of plausible deniability by helping Ukraine to do it or something like that. And then there was a lot on the Hearst report that just was provably false or that got various different movements wrong. But this one feels more likely to me that it could have been the Ukraine doing it. I thought it was quite convenient the way that the story said that Zelensky tried to stop the attack, but it was too late, kind of reducing any blame or blowback on him. I thought, you know, Ukrainian defense officials, apparently they told the Wall Street Journal that they regarded the pipeline as a legitimate Russian target, which I think is fair enough if you're Ukraine, if you're being invaded by Russia. But if this is the truth, that's not going to endear Ukraine to Germany. And I think that's what I'll be very interested to see as we move on from this. If it does go from more from just being a newspaper exclusive report to something that people have looked into and is credible, and if this is what Germany actually believes. You know, we've pointed for a long time that Germany's likely done a deal with Russia several years ago. And even the Nord Stream pipelines themselves were evidence of this kind of a deal where they really tied German industry to Russia. And accelerated the German industry's dependence on Russian gas. It made it very hard for Germany to turn against Russia. That's why these pipelines were so controversial. That's probably even part of why Ukraine targeted them in the first place. Since then, Germany has had this delicate dance of they don't want to publicly break with the United States and publicly break with a lot of people in Europe. They're worried, I think, about how that would affect their European standing. But they keep promising aid to Ukraine. And then when it turns up, it's much less impressive than those written promises actually were. I wonder if this journal report is accurate, whether we could see a much more overt change in Germany's position there.
Just this last week, I heard that even what's on paper for Germany in terms of its donations to Ukraine has been slashed by something like 50% as the result of some recent votes. And I think that if this report ends up swaying German public opinion, we could see more reductions of that kind in the weeks and months ahead.
And I think it could have some pretty dramatic implications for German politics. I mean, there's only two German political parties that are overtly, say, pro-Russia and anti-Ukraine, and they're the two extreme parties. And they kind of, this week, going through the German parliament was this bill about stationing US weapons in Germany, medium-range missiles in Germany, that's about confronting Russia. And it was just the Alternative for Deutschland on the fringe right, and this brand new left-wing party, like Sarah Wagenknecht's party, something like that, on the fringe left. And they are the only ones that were opposed to this. You have this kind of this situation where if Ukraine really did directly attack this German-Russian project, I think that's going to push a lot of people within Germany to those two parties on the far right and far left. I think that could be a big German political shift, which I think would, you know, raise the stature of the fringes, the extreme, and potentially even harm democracy within Germany as power shifts to those anti-democratic parties. But the German-Russian relationship is critical to watch, and Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has a great article on that titled Germany's Secret Deal with Russia Exposed. But so much of this news, so much of what's going on with Russia revolves around Vladimir Putin, this absolutely key, pivotal figure. And you know, we're all speculating, is he coming, is he going, is he staying, what's happening there? But really, I think the fact that so many world events revolve around this one guy is already fulfilled Bible prophecy.
I think that's a fair case to make. You know, it is true that the war has not gone the way Putin and his government and his people thought that it would. And this new Ukrainian invasion, it is a real black eye for the Russians, and it's a significant setback. But it doesn't mean it's the end for Russia's war. And I don't even know if you could say that it means Russia is losing necessarily. You know, Russia's still making incremental gains inside of Ukraine. Of course, that's coming at a stunning loss of life. But Putin has a remarkable tolerance for casualties. It doesn't seem to affect him at all, from what we can tell, to kill tens of thousands of his men in order to accomplish his goals. And he remains hell-bent on taking Ukraine. This new invasion by Ukraine, it could even be something that makes Putin kind of find another gear in his drive against Ukraine and to use some even more aggressive tactics. But in either case, he remains dead set in his resolve to win this war. And the Bible gives us some insight into this resolve. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has called attention to Ezekiel chapter 38, and he says that this is about a specific Russian leader in the modern era, a leader who will be over not just Russia, but a whole block of Asian nations. And Mr. Fleury says that the Russian in this passage is Vladimir Putin. So we still can't say exactly how Russia's, or how Ukraine's incursion, rather, into Kursk will play out, or what all of the exact outcomes of the war will be. But Mr. Fleury stresses that one thing we can be certain about is that Putin will remain in power and will actually grow much more powerful. And we have a Trends article all about this passage, Ezekiel 38, and other related passages as well, and everything that Mr. Fleury has explained about those. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches a Russian Strongman Dominating Asia.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Before we let you go, I had one more question for you. Japan's prime minister, I think he announced he's not going to step up for re-election. What does that mean for the future of Japan and Japanese politics?
Yeah, that was a pretty big surprise announcement that came on Wednesday. Fumio Kishida said that he'll be resigning. He will not run for elections next month for the leadership of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party. So that means Japan will be getting a new prime minister. That'll be the 33rd prime minister that Japan has had since World War II. So the leadership there does change quite often. And it means basically just that there's uncertainty for the world's third largest economy and for the world's, I think it's the sixth or seventh most powerful military. We don't know that much at this point, but we will keep you posted on this as the facts become available.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Well, war in Europe is something kind of terrifying that has become kind of normal. News about nuclear bombs, I think, is something even more so. We've gotten used to a steady drip of news about nuclear weapons for decades now. But some of the top news from Iran revolves around them continually getting closer to a nuclear bomb.
Yes. So on Wednesday, Iran International released a report claiming that Iran is about to start testing nuclear bomb detonators again in a reshuffle, I guess you could say, of their nuclear capabilities, of their nuclear program. We've talked a lot about some of the steps Iran has been taking in nuclear enrichment or in missile development. But there's a whole lot of other components that goes to creating a usable nuclear weapon. And creating the bomb detonators themselves is obviously one of the most important. But there are a few other, again, shall we say, maneuvers that Iran is doing with its nuclear program that they included with the report. One of the big ones is it's restructuring its Organization of Defense Innovation and Research, which is a bit of a mouthful, perhaps doesn't sound too threatening, but it was one of the main government departments in charge of nuclear research in the Iranian Ministry of Defense. It's no longer under the Ministry of Defense anymore. Now it's directly under the thumb of the Ayatollah. And interestingly enough, it's also given an opt-out from the national budget, so it's not accountable to anything, any numbers that Parliament publishes. And, I mean, it doesn't take too many dots connected to realize they're going to be pumping a lot more money in there than they want the public to realize. And I like to say it's, in one sense, Iran already has the bomb. We've heard countless stories of them reaching the threshold of technology, just not putting the parts all together that they could if they wanted to, that they have enough nuclear material to make a bomb. They're just not going through the final step. And what a lot of experts think is that this is just them keeping it in storage for if things get a little bit more heated with Israel, with the United States, they could put it all together in a heartbeat and just say, okay, how do you like this? And this is something we watch with intent. We watch, obviously, most of what Iran does in the geopolitical scene, but especially nuclear weapons. Daniel 11, verse 40, the go-to scripture we talk about, Iran talks about it, getting enough power to go after the king of the north or Europe. If you follow along the prophecy to the next chapter, this is Daniel 12, verse 1. This is what Iran's pushing leads to. Quote, and at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which stands for the children of your people, and there will be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time your people will be delivered, everyone that will be found written in the book, end quote. And you could correlate that with other prophecies, like in Matthew 24, that talks about another unparalleled crisis. All these other prophecies can't be talking about separate, unparalleled crises. It's all the same crisis. And Matthew 24, verse 22, specifically states that if it's not cut short, no flesh would be saved alive, as the Moffat brings out. This is talking about a nuclear war. This is talking about global cataclysm. And Daniel specifically brings out, it all starts with a push from Iran. This nuclear war starts with Iran. And what better way to start a nuclear war or start a nuclear arms race than to develop nuclear weapons in and of yourself? And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, has pointed specifically to that nuclear program in Iran as leading to Daniel 12, as leading to Matthew 24. Now, there's also great hope in that, of course. This is not a doom and gloom prophecy. As Daniel 12 ends, like, your people will be delivered, they'll be rescued. Matthew 24:22 ends with, but those days will be shortened. You can compare it with other prophecies that show it ties in with the return of Christ, with the putting down of all this warfare and all this lawless rebellion from Iran and from everybody, and the start of utopia. But before all that happens, there are some very turbulent times ahead, and it's important to be aware of them as we get closer and closer.
Well, thank you for that well-rounded view. Moving on from nuclear weapons, which kind of almost seems like a funny thing to say, but of course there have been other events going on in the Middle East that we do need to know about.
Yes, so at least as of the day of recording today, in Doha, Qatar, ceasefire talks have started between Israel and Hamas. A lot of people didn't think these talks would even happen, and there's a lot of question on the good faith on both sides, whether they actually expect to create an agreement from this, or whether they're just giving something to please all their international, all the countries giving them pressure. There's been a lot of tension on how Iran is going to retaliate, and Supreme Leader Khamenei has said he still plans on retaliating, but nothing's happened yet. And that goes to, well, a lot of people are wondering why. Some people have linked it to the ceasefire talks. Maybe he's hoping that this will be an easy way out. He certainly has had a lot more pressure than before from Europe, including from Germany. Even the Vatican has said that, told Iran to stand down. That's something we're watching for the Catholic Church to get more involved in the Middle East. And also, Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian has had his cabinet picks going through the parliamentary process for confirmation. But one person that we talked to, I think, on this program before is Abbas Araghchi, who was the nuclear negotiator for the old Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Barack Obama's nuclear deal back in 2015. Now he's poised to become foreign minister. One Iranian MP quoted him saying, "The JCPOA is beyond revival. In the new government, our focus is not on restoring the nuclear deal, but on lifting the sanctions," end quote. Now, the whole point of the JCPOA was to get those sanctions lifted in exchange for token cosmetic scaling back of its nuclear program. But if this quote from his parliamentary confirmation is true, that means they're still going to try to move forward with the nuclear program and remove the sanctions at the same time, have their cake and eat it too. How they plan on doing that is anyone's guess, but it ties in with the main story on how we can still expect Iran to keep moving forward to a nuclear bomb. If you'd like to learn more about that, we have a trends article called "Why the Trumpet Watches Iran's Pursuit of Nuclear Weapons." I could put the whole story, both what Iran's doing and of the Bible, what the Bible says, into context.
Thank you very much for that, Mihailo. Well, I've been slipping bits of European news into other people's sections. Feels quite appropriate for European powers to be invading other regions, but I did have a European story in its own right that I wanted to bring you to finish off. Last week, we talked about US debt with Andrew, and this week, one of the biggest stories out of Germany, it's been going on for about a fortnight, is an absolutely massive contrast to that. And so I wanted to put things in some easy to follow numbers. If we think of comparing these two, Germany and America, as comparing two families. To keep everything simple, these two families, they both earn $100,000 a year. In this example, the US is $123,000 in debt. And instead of paying it off, they're borrowing more money. They seem absolutely, completely unconcerned by this massive debt. They're planning on borrowing another $7,500 this year. Now their salary is going up. The price of their house is going up. But this is overall a deeply indebted family with no plans to turn it around. It's growing its debt every year by more than its salary is growing, going deeper and deeper into debt. And if you were advising that family, know, you tell them you need to turn this around. And I think you'd be most concerned by that attitude of complete unconcern, that it's not even on their radar. Anything that comes up, their attitude is just, yeah, whatever, you know, stick it on the credit card, it'll sort itself out. So if their income, if they're a family with an income of $100,000 a year, their debt would be about $60,000, less than half America's. And they're expecting to borrow only $1,750 this year, not the $7,500 that America is planning on borrowing. But the biggest difference is their attitude towards that debt, where Germany is not just, yeah, whatever, put it on the credit card. They're actually having massive family fights and rows over this debt. They're deeply concerned about this figure. Members of the family are all sacrificing. They're all going without things that they want because they're concerned about the level of debt. And that brings us to this story over the last couple of weeks where Germany's coalition is at risk of falling because of a dispute of what would basically be $100 in the scale of things in this story. A $100 payment for a family that's £60,000 in debt, and it's going to lead to a divorce. Or that's not definitely. Germany's coalition has had a lot of fights, but that's the kind of the picture here. And I think there's two parts to that story. Both are important. One is just how fragile Germany's coalition is, that a relatively small amount of money could make it all fall apart. I mean, maybe it will, maybe it won't, but that doesn't say a lot about their long-term stability. But in the long run, when you see how seriously Germany takes debt, how big of an issue it is in Germany, I think it also says a lot about America's cavalier attitude and really helps us see how worrying America's attitude is. So this is all about the budget for the next fiscal year. And Germany has in their constitution a hard limit on how much the country can borrow each year. And so German governments want to spend, particularly coalition governments. Coalition governments really want to spend because now you've got three parties that all have different bases, different voters that they feel like they've got to give perks to. And they want to be able to hand those out. But then this line in the coalition stops them from just borrowing money to do that. So to get around this, they came up at the start of the summer, back in June, July, with some creative accounting. They would take money from a government-owned investment bank. They would move that into a government pot. Also, they were going to redefine loans to the Deutsche Bahn Railway Company, to the Autobahn, to the roads. They were going to redefine government loans to those as financial transactions, and then they weren't going to count as debt. So this is what they were going to do to get around this debt problem. They agreed on the deal back June, July, but then the finance minister, Christian Lindner, he ordered an investigation into whether or not it was legal. And the investigation just came back and said, no, it's not legal. And so now they've got to find more savings. And the main bit that they're focusing on that's not legal is taking money out of that investment bank. And that is €5 billion. The German economy is €4 trillion each year. So it's a relatively small sum. And the coalition government is getting into one of these other coalition crisis existential arguments about it. Now, I think it's probably most likely it won't fall. All of these parties would do terribly if there was an election tomorrow, and they all know that. So they've got a pretty strong reason to try and stick together for as long as they can until the next election. But what an expose on Germany's weak government. We have a free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, that takes you through why we're expecting a radical shift in German government. And if you have German parties fighting, squabbling, falling apart, and that shows you Germany has struggled to have a functioning government, a really stable, strong government for a long time. And I think as people see that and they're living in a dangerous world, they're going to want a strong leader. And that's that European Antiochus that we were talking about right at the start with Andrew. And that Strong German Leader is Imminent booklet will take you through some of those scriptures that prophesy of an Antiochus. It'll tell you about some of that history. It will tell you ultimately why we're expecting a strong leader within Germany, why that's such a key prophecy. That figure is really going to drive Bible prophecy forwards. So that booklet shows why we're expecting him. And I think all of these coalition squabbles within Germany tell us we're nearly there. That guy is coming very soon because the German government is just struggling to function with business as usual. There's a real appetite for a strong leader to sort all of this out. But then also there's that second part, America's debt. Germany at least is trying to deal with this debt problem while America blithely ignores it. And yeah, there's a lot of stress within Germany as they try to get this debt under control. But it's going to be much easier to get it under control now rather than let it all explode. And America, shows no signs of trying to get it all under control. They're just going to let it all explode. And that's another forecast that we're waiting for. We have the Trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches America's Economic Collapse. We talked about that at more length last week, and they're related. America's economic collapse is very likely going to play a role in, you know, that's massive turmoil for everyone anywhere in the world. That's a crisis for Europe. That's going to play a role in Europe wanting a strong leader to come and get them out of this mess. And Andrew last week talked about some of the statements that Herbert W. Armstrong made about the way that an American economic collapse is going to lead to the rise of a united Europe under this strongman. So keep watching that story as well. Well, that's your rundown of all of this week's news. Thank you so much to all of our panelists. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for getting us set up for engineering and production. If you have any comments, questions, please do get in touch with trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Please give us a like, a subscribe, leave us a comment. That really helps us on YouTube or on Rumble, wherever you're getting to this. We also have it. You can access this on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, all kinds of different places. So thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.